The Green Sundays are the time of year when in the church's preaching and teaching, the focus is on the nature of Christian discipleship, the cost of Christian discipleship, the ways and the means that you and I have of putting into our hands the deep things of Christian living. So the preaching, at least in my view, ought to take on something of a didactic quality. That means teaching. And what I, during my vacation, I watched a number of the design and garden shows on that channel on cable. It's the
House and Garden.
And I heard a number of the interior decorators, I guess you can't say that anymore, interior designers say that because they did this, the other thing popped. So what popped for me, reading the gospel, was that the focus of the Savior's message in these parables was about humility. So this sermon affords the opportunity to talk about what humility might mean in an affirmative and positive sense, a virtue with regard to the maturation of the spiritual life of individual Christian people and the community of faith we call the church. In 1969, I think he was a psychoanalyst, I'm not sure. His name was Philip Reif, R-E-I-F-F, wrote a book called The Triumph of the Therapeutic. And he defined the culture that you and I live in as the therapeutic culture. One of the things he said was a sign of the therapeutic culture was that we believe that success can be defined by a manipulatable sense of well-being. Whatever you may think that means, the question of the way in which we understand valuing feeling over thinking, and the way in which we understand certain kinds of feelings as not being positive for a person's emotional health loom large in the culture in which we find ourselves. On one level, they should. But on another level, it often is the result of an enormous misunderstanding, because humility does not mean low self-esteem. And low self-esteem, as we know in this culture, is a big problem for many. In fact, the state of California a number of years ago set aside quite a bit of money to study the negative and deleterious effects of low self-esteem. What I'm going to preach about is not humiliation or denigration, but the affirmative understanding of knowing yourself. The word humility in English comes from a Latin word, humus, humus, which means the ground or soil, low. So I suspect it is true to say that I know my family would say so-and-so comes from humble circumstances. They would mean some species of economic deprivation or lack of one form or another. In the Latin West, that was the understanding of humble in the time of Jesus and before in Roman society. But with Judaism and Christianity, the idea of humility, the denial of self, took on some virtuous qualities. But like all spiritual, emotional, and intellectual categories, humility went through a period of development and understanding. By the time we get to the Middle Ages, the High Middle Ages, St. Thomas Aquinas would say, humility is knowing yourself. It is not having either an overweening belief in your own powers and abilities, nor an exaggerated self-negation of your abilities. It is the recognition that there are some things that you can do better than somebody else. Just as there are things others can do better than you. And so it is not a prudent thing to deny that, but to own it and to say, this is what I am able to do. So humility, in one sense, is self-knowledge. In the therapeutic culture, self-knowledge is a good thing, isn't it? All of us need to know ourselves. Those of us who have been in the helping professions for any length of time have sat down and talked to people and had them tell, and they have told us about themselves. And sometimes you look at them and listen to them and you say to yourself, how in the world do they have this view of themselves? Someone at the sermon discussion group referred to a study I was familiar with. Some sociologists from Berkeley a number of years ago went over to San Quentin and some of the other prisons thinking that when they interviewed the prisoners, they were going to discover that they got themselves into hot water with the law because of low self-esteem. And what they found out was that they got themselves into hot water with the law because their self-esteem was too high. They didn't know themselves. So Thomas Aquinas is thinking about balance in terms of self-knowledge and your ability. How do you share the practical wisdom that you've gained over time with others? And how do you open yourself in humility to receive the practical wisdom that is directed towards you in love or concern or just plain mature relating? And how do you own that and put it to good use? So working on being a humble person is at the heart of our self-understanding. When the idea of living the moral life as connected to the virtues became important in Christianity, those who wrote and preached and taught about this said, humility is the opposite of overweening pride. So it's the seeking of balance about who you are, what you can do, and how you use the gifts that God has given to you. In the gospel today, we have what is called by many in biblical scholarship the parable of the great dinner. Another good line in our culture, right? Particularly with foodies. The parable of the great dinner. Now here's some 3995 biblical scholarship. Luke, our patron, wrote a gospel for the Gentiles. Luke was a Gentile. His Greek, by the way, is the best of the New Testament. He is the Shakespeare of the New Testament. Luke's audience were Gentiles who had been influenced by what we call, in historical terms, Hellenistic culture, Greek culture. And so when they look at Jesus and say, how do I understand who he is and what he means? The easiest way for me to access that is to see him in the categories of a person of wisdom in the Hellenist way. And the location for the expounding of wisdom like this was at great dinners in Hellenistic life. In fact, these great dinners were called symposia. You heard that word? Symposium. So here's what happened. You go, you have a great dinner, then you stop eating, and you start drinking wine in earnest. then you start talking about the good, the true, and the beautiful, and philosophical matters of one kind or another, or, as is even true in this culture, you go to a dinner party and it ends up being whether you got the midnight blue Lexus or the Mercedes SUV. So it doesn't, stay at a very high level often. And that was true even in Greek times. But Jesus, to Luke and to his listenership and readership, was a person of wisdom. And so he's at a great dinner talking about this stuff. Two big shots. Now, on one level, he speaks about humbling yourself to be exalted and not exalting yourself, or you'll be humbled. So he's speaking about this, and there is a level at which he is explaining this to people, which sounds like the ancient Near East version of Letitia Baldridge or Miss Manners or Emily Post. Helpful social hints from the Savior of the world. You know, when you go to a dinner party, don't sit in the expensive seats, sit in the cheap seats. Then you get invited by the big cheese to sit up. Your self-esteem will not suffer. And you will then be a person of humility. Well, duh. But here's where the hook is. The hook is, you know what I'm speaking about here? And he's saying this to the religious leadership that he's sitting with at the great dinner. You have got yourself enmeshed in a social web of payback, of social obligation, of self-aggrandizement and advancement, and of a lot of hierarchical tyranny that does not do the best for the most. And it is important for us to understand that if we are going to model the habits of the kingdom, we ought not to be having great dinners where we have this self-congratulatory group that is patting each other into shape and moving us toward greater success and prosperity as our principal focus, but we ought to pay attention to those on the margins who need to come. Now, I always read Gospels like this and ask myself, what am I going to do with this? I happen to know that tomorrow morning I'm not going to begin to invite over to my house a whole lot of halt, lame, and blind people to come and have dinner with me. Not much. And neither are you. So how are we going to begin to have some sense made out of this? And my suggestion might be is to see how, over time, we have seen the grace of God work on our community life as church. Who do we welcome at the table? And use the term table in a broader metaphoric sense, not just to eat with people, but who gets to come and help make the decisions about who we are, what we do, and how we see our way forward. When I first became an Episcopalian, the parish that I belonged to, and certainly the churches in its vicinity, wouldn't have thought about inviting people who were members of that parish to come into positions of leadership and authority and power unless they were somebody. Unless they were big givers. Unless they were socially prominent. Unless they'd been there for a long time. Unless they had a name. I'm sure in some places that's still true. But in the Episcopal Church, over the last 35 years, we have made progress with regard to inviting others to positions of leadership, to the table, to the way in which we understand our common life that has enriched who we are and has done what Thomas Aquinas suggested, which was to say we recognize in certain people talents and abilities that they possess, ways of seeing the world that we do not have, and they can help and supplement those talents and abilities that we have as we move forward in leadership. This is unfinished business institutionally in our church and also in the wider society. And you and I might be advocates for seeing that that process continues, that we extend our welcome, as it says today in the Epistle to the Hebrews, that our hospitality is to be one of the principal functions of the community of faith. So this week, give thanks for the fact that you and your talents and abilities count for something. That what you do and who you are is part of God's plan for the world in big and small ways. That the encouragement and the support our esteem receives by virtue of that comes from the unconditional love, acceptance, and forgiveness of God that is given to us without remainder. And finally, when you understand that you are unconditionally loved, accepted, and forgiven, you are able to move things one inch closer to God's plan for the world.